This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, I'm Linda Mottram. In this episode, Australian coal exports stopped in their tracks in China, national lessons from Sydney's cracked and crumbling Opal Tower, and breaking the law to get medicinal cannabis. Welcome to PM. We may be the closest of friends, but Australia's relationship with New Zealand is being tested again over asylum seekers, but also over the perennial irritant of criminal deportations. New Zealand's Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, described the issue as corrosive as she hosted her Australian counterpart, Scott Morrison, in Auckland today. She's also been forced to deny a report that New Zealand's offer to take 150 refugees would exclude single men on Manus Island. Our Foreign Affairs reporter Stephen Jedgetts is in Auckland watching these meetings. Stephen, hello. Corrosive, a very strong word to use. How did that conversation between the two leaders go?
Well, Linda, it was really a fairly frank exchange by all accounts. As you say, this is a long-running irritant in the relationship. Now it's almost an open sore. Successive New Zealand prime ministers, of course, have complained about this policy to deport New Zealand, to deport citizens who commit serious crimes. Now, this policy, we should be clear, it doesn't specifically target New Zealanders. It covers all nationalities, but New Zealand says it's particularly unfair to them because large numbers of the New Zealanders who are deported across the Tasman, and there have been more than 1,500 in the last few years, actually have very strong links to Australia. Some have spent their whole lives in Australia and say they have no real connection to New Zealand at all. So New Zealand argues that it's basically unfair to the criminals because they're being sent to almost an alien country, and that it's unfair to the state of New South Wales because many of those people then reoffend, which places a burden on the criminal justice system over the ditch. Now, Jacinda Ardern's raised this before today, but she's signalled during her talks with Scott Morrison today that she really does want to escalate this issue, perhaps suggesting that Australia can't continue with this policy without damaging other elements of the friendship. Let's take a listen to the Prime Minister.
In my view, this issue has become corrosive in our relationship over time. I made it clear that New Zealand has no issue with Australia taking a dim view of newly arrived non-citizens committing crimes. But equally, the New Zealand people have a dim view of the deportation of people who moved to Australia as children and have grown up there, with often little or no lasting connection to here. I'm sure it is a matter that we will continue to discuss.
The New Zealand Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern. So, Stephen, also that newspaper report about the refugee officer offer a leak to a newspaper from the Australian side. How have the New Zealand side responded?
That's right. New Zealand, of course, has a long-standing offer to resettle 150 refugees on both Manus Island and Nauru. Now, this morning, Courier Mail reported that that offer actually came with some conditions, alleging that New Zealand officials warned Australian officials they were only willing to take families off Nauru, not single men on Manus Island. Now, Jacinda Ardern denied that story today. She said New Zealand did have a preference for families, not single men, but it was never an absolute ban. So clearly, Linda, there are some semantic games going on here. There are some, it seems, in the Australian system who feel there's a whiff of hypocrisy, if you like, on the New Zealand side. And Scott Morrison made it very clear that Australia is certainly not going to take up the offer to resettle refugees, saying he was even more determined to say no after Parliament passed the so-called Medivac legislation. Let's take a listen to him earlier today.
When it comes to the New Zealand arrangement, it's something we touch on every time we're here. The Australian government has no plans to take up that arrangement whatsoever, and that is particularly now more pertinent on the basis of what happened in the Parliament last week. That, I think, now makes that even more difficult than it was before.
Scott Morrison, the Prime Minister in New Zealand today. Stephen, we shouldn't overstate this, of course. We're not at war. There are vast areas of agreement, particularly on the newly challenging situation in the Pacific.
Yes, that's right. Both countries have attempted over the last few years to really intensify diplomatic engagement. We call it very different things. We call it the Pacific Step Up. New Zealand calls it the Reset. But the aim is the same, to basically really ramp up our diplomacy in the region in the face of what we both see, both countries, as a common threat to that influence, namely China's rising influence. Today, Scott Morrison and Jacinda Ardern tried to come to some agreement about how to try and work together to make sure that those two initiatives were complementary rather than clashing, making it clear that our vision for the Pacific is very much a shared one.
Stephen Jedgetts, thank you very much. Stephen is our foreign affairs reporter. He's in Auckland with the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison. Well, there's been an appeal for calm coming from the government this evening in the face of a ban on Australian coal imports into China. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, is playing down the potential economic impact of the decision, while his Trade Minister, Simon Birmingham, is denying that China has singled out Australian coal. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon in Canberra.
Instead of being unloaded at the major Chinese port city of Dalian, Australian thermal coal sitting on ships waiting for other Chinese ports have also blocked access. The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, on an official visit to New Zealand, is playing down the issue.
People should be careful about leaping to conclusions about this. This is not the first time that on occasion local ports make decisions about these matters.
Speculation has been rife. Cryptic statements from the Chinese Foreign Ministry and a lack of forewarning to Australian officials about the import restriction haven't helped. The Prime Minister, though, is using history as his guide and blaming the sudden imposition of a quota to protect the local Chinese coal industry.
There is nothing, no evidence before me or us that would suggest that it has the connotations that it has anything to do with anything more broadly than that. This happens from time to time, and we just work constructively with our partners in China about those issues.
His Trade Minister, Simon Birmingham, is refusing to even use the B word.
We have no basis to believe that there is a ban on Australian coal exports into China or into any part of China.
His explanation for the hold-up uses similar language to a Chinese Foreign Ministry statement issued this morning.
The application of those quotas combined with different testing in terms of quality assurance of products and environmental testing and standards may be slowing down the processing of coal in certain ports across China.
And despite reports coal exports to China from other major suppliers like Indonesia and Russia haven't been affected, Senator Birmingham says he's been assured Australia's not come in for special treatment.
We do not believe that this is isolated to Australia, but may well be and is likely to be applicable to other coal exporters into China as well.
Newswire Reuters first reported what it's describing as a ban. Since then, the minister and officials have been in overdrive trying to get solid information from the Chinese side.
I've been in touch and working with Australia's embassy in Beijing. Our foreign affairs and trade officials have been working with the Chinese embassy in Canberra.
But there's still nothing firm to go on about when coal shipments can resume or whether the new quota will also extend from thermal coal to coking coal, as some exporters fear. The Resources Minister, Matt Canavan, is playing down the economic impact of what's already happened.
This is a relatively small amount of coal exports in the context of our export market, and that it's likely that any displacement will find other markets as well.
Senator Birmingham says quota restrictions of the past have come out in the wash long term.
When we've seen that slow before, we've equally then seen a very quick pickup occur subsequently.
But the opposition remains to be convinced, especially with so little to go on from the Chinese side. Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen.
This would be, if it came to pass, in relation to other ports in China, a very significant and negative economic development for Australia.
Some have speculated the recent decision to deny Chinese network provider Huawei access to the tender to build Australia's new 5G mobile phone network could be related to the quota.
Obviously, if it is a result of deterioration in bilateral relations, that's very concerning, and we would have more to say about that. But I don't think it's particularly useful for me to speculate in the absence of further evidence.
The Shadow Treasurer Chris Bowen, Tom Eagledon, our reporter in Canberra. There are new calls for federal action to improve oversight of the construction industry after the New South Wales government today released its final report into Sydney's troubled Opal Tower. It's found numerous construction and material deficiencies in the 36-storey complex, and it makes recommendations about the regulation of the building sector. The complex was evacuated on Christmas Eve after residents heard a loud cracking noise. And almost 2 months on, many of the apartments remain empty. Madeline Jenner reports.
It's been almost 2 months since the Opal apartment tower at Sydney's Olympic Park was evacuated, and few residents are keen to move back in. The ABC understands that more than 250 units in the 392-unit apartment block remain empty. Lots of renters have moved elsewhere and owners are living in temporary accommodation.
I'm currently not living in the building. I am an owner here. In light of the report today, I think it's important that the builders now sit down with the owners and have frank discussions about the way forward.
Today, the New South Wales government released its final report into the tower, finding that parts of the building were constructed using lower strength concrete with under-designed critical support beams. But the report, written by three of the state's most senior engineers, stopped short of pinning the responsibility on the builder or the engineers involved. The engineering company, WSP, said today that while the final building did not meet the building code, the design they signed off on did. The government report also made recommendations about the need for further regulation of the building industry. And New South Wales Minister for Better Regulation, Matt Keane, says his government will act.
From day one, the government's focus has been the residents. When people purchase a property in New South Wales, they have every right to expect that that property is safe, structurally sound, and free from major defects. This is not just an issue in New South Wales, it's an issue right across the country.
Among the recommendations, the creation of a registry of engineers and a building structure review board. Jason Jayon is a professor of concrete structures at Swinburne University. He says that while Opal has been in the news, the types of defects seen in the building are occurring way too often in the construction phase before people move in. That means they don't get the media attention, but it highlights a real issue in the industry at the moment.
This particular builder and the designers were just unlucky to get caught, because what they've done is not out of the ordinary. It could have been any one of the other buildings. They've just been unlucky to have this failure. This is my opinion. And I think it's the problem is endemic. And I think the main issue is the structural engineer and the designer's role in construction industry in the past couple of decades been slowly and steadily declining because of the cost savings.
Away from the Opal Tower issue, greater regulation of the building industry is already being discussed at a federal level, thanks to a separate national review of Australia's building and construction industry. Peter McIntyre is the CEO of Engineers Australia. He says improved regulations can't come soon enough.
Unfortunately, at the moment, anybody can call themselves an engineer. Thankfully, most people working are professional and have the right skills and competence, but there's no guarantee of that. Engineers Australia does maintain a register nationally of over 20,000 engineers, but there's no legislative teeth behind that. So we can disbar members and warn members and control those on our register, but they can then simply leave the register and go and practice in the shadows.
Peter McIntyre is the CEO of Engineers Australia. Madeline Jenner, our reporter. This is PM. I'm Linda Mottram. You can get in touch with me on Twitter. I'm at Linda Mottram. Remember the innovation agenda? It was a Malcolm Turnbull speciality. Well, PM is told it has stalled. Entrepreneurs weigh in on the state of our startups, particularly the challenges of finding venture capital.
Around the globe, you know, they see Australian startups as cockroaches. you just can't kill. Like, we have a good name overseas, that we have this determination. And I think maybe some of that's because funding is so different here.
A Colombian cardinal has warned fellow Roman Catholic bishops at a Vatican summit that they could be imprisoned for covering up crimes if they don't deal properly with clergy sex abuse cases under a proposed code of conduct. Cardinal Ruben Salazar Gomez denounced bishops for tending to believe priests over the abused and accused the church of buying the silence of survivors with the frequent use of confidentiality agreements.
Actuando de esa manera, manifestamos claramente una mentalidad clerical.
Acting in this way, we clearly manifest a clerical mentality that leads us to misunderstand the institution of the church and place it above the suffering of the victims and the demands of justice. This mentality accepts the justifications of the perpetrators over the testimony of those affected. It silences the cry of pain of the victimised so as to avoid the public noise that a denunciation before civil authorities or a trial can provoke.
He took aim during discussions at the summit of some 200 senior church figures from around the world, called by the Pope and aiming to stop child sexual abuse in the church. But one American legal scholar says the church is still missing a key part of making good on this crisis. Timothy Litton is Distinguished University Professor and Professor of Law at Georgia State University. His book, Holding Bishops Accountable, looks at how lawsuits have helped do just that. We spoke earlier.
The one thing that the church seems resistant to over the course of the last 25 years in this scandal is a really deep dive and an open exploration into the measures that have been taken by bishops to keep all of this abuse concealed, whether it's to keep it from church parishioners or to keep it from justice authorities in the civil justice or criminal justice system. The bishops have lots of responses, but they don't usually include holding themselves accountable for their cover-up of this over the last 25 years.
And when you say full accounting, do you mean a full accounting before civil courts is required?
No, it's not clear to me that a lot of the misconduct of the bishops rises to the level of either crimes or civil infractions. In some cases, it may. And in fact, it looks like in a number of indictments in the United States, it has. But a fuller accounting that deals with really putting back the legitimacy of the institution. I think the bishops spend a lot of time trying to figure out how they can regain the trust of the people in themselves. And I think what they miss is that what people want is a restoration of trust in the institution.
The Pope has now used the words, "I was part of the problem," and he has vowed that the church will never again cover up clergy sex abuse. Are we closer to that full accounting, do you think, that you're describing?
No, I actually think that this is a diversionary tactic in a way. The church since the 1980s, certainly in the United States, has demonstrated a pattern in their reaction to revelations of abuse. It's a three-part pattern, if you will. The first is apology. The bishops come out and they apologize. Now, they sometimes apologize for their wrongdoing, but more often they apologize for what the priest did wrong or what somebody else did wrong. In the United States, there's a lot of apologizing for what Cardinal McCarrick did wrong. The best that we get sometimes is an apology that the collective bishops have failed the people. The second is sympathy, trying to understand victims' pain better or feeling empathy with victims' pain. And the third of these is policy, the idea that they're going to promise that this will never happen again. There will be new safeguards in the church. And the one thing missing here is a counting of what it is that the bishops knew, when they knew it was going on, and why it is that they didn't stop it. So it's one thing for the Pope to say, you know, I failed you, but the Pope has to say more about how he failed, why he failed, why it is that this cover-up is still going on. Let's leave the church and sexual abuse aside for a moment, and let's talk about political scandal. If you think back to the Watergate scandal in the United States, which is a very famous cover-up, it was not enough for the American people, in order to restore their faith in government, for Richard Nixon to apologize for what he did wrong, to sympathize with the people who he hurt, and for the American government to then say, well, we pledge this will never happen, we'll put new policy in place. All of those things may be important, but the country had to go through a very careful investigation of what it is that Richard Nixon knew about the crimes involved in Watergate, when he knew about them, and what his role was in covering them up. That's what the Mueller investigation is about now. And until we have those sorts of explanations and accounting for people's actions who are currently in power, we tend not to have any faith in the institutions that they work in.
So who should do this accounting? Surely not the church itself.
There's really only one group who needs to come clean here at this point, and that's the bishops themselves.
And you don't believe this Pope is ready to do this?
The Pope has given no indication that he is interested in uncovering all of the various things that bishops have done to conceal this. That conversation has not been started, and this current Vatican summit doesn't seem to have that on the agenda at all. What's on the agenda of this Vatican summit, as far as I can tell, is an apology, which has been forthcoming every day, sympathy and a hearing session and a listening session with victims so that they feel the sense of empathy from the bishops, and this talk about educating the bishops, which is important, and finally, a policy of zero tolerance. But nobody has talked about getting down to the question of what it is that the bishops knew, when they knew it, and what they did to conceal it.
Timothy Litton, thank you very much for speaking with PM.
Thank you, my pleasure.
Timothy Litton is Distinguished University Professor and Professor of Law at Georgia State University. Well, more than 100,000 Australians are self-medicating with illicit medical cannabis, experts say. and they're describing it as a sign of a failed system. Now, earlier this week, the federal government trumpeted the approval by authorities of a total of 3,000 medical cannabis scripts in the 10 months to January this year, after restrictions were relaxed last year. But experts say the system is still putting significant blockages in the way for vast numbers of people, forcing them onto the black market. And those experts are calling for an independent regulator. Meghna Bali reports.
This is what you normally see right before a seizure,
isn't it? Yes, shivery. We saw the facial jerks before.
The day Michael Lambert watched his infant daughter suffer a 2.5-hour seizure, he decided to break the law.
Some people overseas had the same disease and were being helped by hemp cannabis.
Diagnosed with intractable epilepsy at 11 months old, Caitlin Lambert could seize every 15 seconds for hours on end. Now age 7, she averages just one seizure a year. Her father believes it's because of the illegal cannabis oil he's been giving her for 5 years, and he makes no apologies for how he got it.
She has catastrophic epilepsy. The side effect is she gets her life back. She doesn't get brain damage. She can live. She can breathe. And they can't stop it. They can't stop it, but I can with a little bit of hemp.
But he's paid for his actions. He was found guilty of possession and cultivation in 2017, but no conviction was recorded. Carol Ireland is Managing Director at Epilepsy Action Australia. She says it's not an isolated case.
Unfortunately, we know of more families that are using illicit cannabis than have accessed it through legal pathways. They're not hippies. The families are in, you know, between a rock and a hard place.
The Therapeutic Goods Administration has found evidence that medicinal cannabis oil can prompt dramatic improvements for children with drug-resistant epilepsy. But limited information is available about its use for a wider range of conditions. And little data on appropriate dosing for individual products means there's only one registered medicinal cannabis oil on the market. All unregistered medicines must be applied for through the TGA with supporting documentation from a doctor. But a lengthy application, lack of education among practitioners, and high costs are driving people like Michael Lambert to the black market.
$585 for one bottle, and we've estimated that's between $53,000 and $123,000 a year. And I can get it $7.50 a day on the black market.
Rhys Cohn from Sydney University's Lambert Institute for Cannabinoid Therapeutics says costs can be driven up by a complex supply chain for these products.
There might be a cultivator overseas, a manufacturer, an international distributor, a local distributor, and a pharmacy all taking their cut.
The government claims it's streamlined the process. But advocate Lucy Haslam says it's no easier.
I'm bitterly disappointed, actually. I used to be very proud of what we'd done. Now we find that the government's trying to put a lot of spin on it and claim that it's been victorious, but it's actually been a disaster for patients.
And she's joined the Greens in calling for a national regulator for medicinal cannabis.
Every other country with a sophisticated medicinal cannabis program has elected to set about doing it through an independent regulator.
Michael Lambert says he's running out of options.
From the health minister to the Prime Minister, I wrote to them all. I begged for help. They told me, we're going to come up with a solution. Just hang in tight. Just keep doing what you're doing.
Michael Lambert there, and Meghna Bali, our reporter, did put questions for that report to the New South Wales and Federal Health Ministers. They declined to comment. Well, innovation was a catch cry during the early years of the Turnbull government. There was an innovation statement in 2015 that pledged almost $1.1 billion for what the then Prime Minister called an ideas boom. But amidst rumblings from some innovators about an impenetrable system that does little to help them, one respected business figure says the government has talked a big game and failed to deliver. Angus Randall reports.
It was supposed to smooth Australia's economic transformation after the mining boom. Just 3 months after taking power in 2015, Malcolm Turnbull announced more than $1 billion in funding for innovation.
We've got to be prepared to do things differently tomorrow than we did yesterday, because the pace of change in the world in which we live is unprecedentedly fast.
The term innovation is used widely in the tech and startup industry. Roy Green is Emeritus Professor at the University of Technology, Sydney.
Essentially, it means doing new things that add value to our economy and to our society, or doing things we currently do in a new way.
He paints a picture of a government that went big on innovation but failed to back it up.
The innovation agenda has since stalled. partly because the government lost interest, especially after the 2016 election, when it appeared that innovation might be on the nose.
Data from the Australian Bureau of Statistics shows government spending on research and development, a core part of innovation, shrank 5% in the 2016-17 financial year. Roy Green warns Australia risks falling behind the rest of the world.
What we have is a set of very fragmented policies which are becoming even more fragmented over time, because instead of spending more on programs, we spend less, but divide them up with different names to give the appearance that something significant is happening.
Those supporting the next generation of startups say they're looking to get innovation back on the government's agenda. Alex McCauley is the CEO of tech startup advocacy group Startup Oz.
This is an important time to be having that conversation, because as we go into an election, we're going to be looking to both parties to outline a vision for the future and how Australia can stay prosperous as we have done for the last 25 years. And I think a reasonable person looking at that scenario would probably come to the conclusion that we need to do more with technology and with human intellectual capital, which is really our biggest asset.
Joseph Nalavansky founded Image Cloud in 2014. It provides cloud software for photographers. The company was funded without government support. He believes a tough environment in Australia has created a community of resilient entrepreneurs.
Around the globe, you know, they see Australian startups as cockroaches. you just can't kill. Like, we have a good name overseas, that we have this determination. And I think maybe some of that's because funding is so different here.
Others have a more positive outlook for the future of Australian innovation. The software company Curvew raised $1 million through the government's CSIRO Innovation Fund, which brings government and private money together in a competitive process. Curvew's video conferencing technology allows healthcare professionals to take appointments over the internet. Dr. Sylvia Pfeiffer is the company's CEO.
We now have probably about $3 billion worth of VC investment available in Australia. There's a whole bunch of funds that have $200 million each, if not more by now. It's impressive to see the change. However, we still don't have enough investment for all the startups that are now being created, that are being encouraged to be created in Australia.
So what's needed? Roy Green from the University of Technology Sydney reckons more government money is a start.
If the money is there, for example, to encourage greater collaboration, which we don't do all that well between business and industry, if it's there to encourage startup activity by maybe providing space for startups, often rents are a big issue, especially in the centre of our big cities.
The Federal Industry Minister, Karen Andrews, says the government is increasing research and development funding by more than $850 million over the next 4 years.
Angus Randall reporting, and that's PM for this week. Thanks to the team, including our supervising producer, David Cody. Technical production by Jane Stacey, Matthew Speller and Alan Arthur. And our researcher this week was Flint Duxfield. You can find us on the app, on the web and the podcast version, of course. Join Nick Grimm tomorrow for Saturday AM with the latest from the Vatican Summit, among other stories. And we're back on Monday evening. I'm Linda Mottram. Now on RN, it's Download This Show with Mark Fennell. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.